This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello, have you missed me?
Oh, husky one.
I've been very poorly.
Probably the best lager in the world.
Oh, the voice. Yeah. I can play you a clip of what my voice sounded like 2 days ago.
Oh, go on then.
For full disclosure, I'm recording this bit the day after I recorded the part with Annabelle, and as you can hear, my voice has gone severely downhill. So that's what I sounded like on the other podcast this week. So
your other podcast.
You got lucky. The voice is coming back for this one.
And in time for the live show.
Yeah, and you were very generous with your advice. You told me to go to A&E and ask for steroids.
It's true, I did.
Which I didn't do.
Burden on the health service.
Ed also warned me that if I was to take steroids for my lost voice, then maybe I'd become depressed as well, and I don't need steroids.
They have side effects these days.
Yeah, so I gave them a wide berth. But you recommended some Vocal Zone throat pastels.
Yeah, there are other throat pastels on the market. I hasten to add,
but those were the ones you would use for Prime Minister's Question Time.
Yeah, there was something else. There was some kind of liquid as well. What was that called? Sanderson or something? The opera singers use. I think it's called Sanderson or something. I did get worried when you croaked at me on Tuesday.
Yes, because we've got the live show, as you say, coming up on Sunday.
We do.
Ed was worried that I might just have to sit there as a ventriloquist dummy.
Yeah, I was thinking about who my alternatives might be. None of them were as good as you. Exciting, the live show. People who are listening to this episode will hear it next week. It'll be out on Monday, the 5th of February. We're talking about mental health. We've got a great lineup, which I'm incredibly excited about. Ruby Wax, who's obviously a comedian, people know that, but she's trained as a psychologist. She's written, she's got a new book out. She's written a book on mental health previously. George Ezra, the singer-songwriter, who I'm a huge fan of, and he's talked about mental health himself.
You went for lunch with him this week.
I went for lunch with him. I had a selfie in front of the Pitt the Younger statue. Jeremy Corbyn
he gate crashed.
His neck sneaked in first and got a picture with George. But George is a very charming
So when you go for lunch with somebody at the House of Commons, are you only allowed to invite one person at a time?
I did think about this last night. I sent you the text, I did think about this. I am incredibly sorry.
Wow, that sounds great. Lunch at the House of Commons, looking at that statue of Pitt the Younger.
I'm really sorry. I know. I did think about this. I did think I wonder
that's,
why.
That's good to know. Good to I know that think, you thought about it after the
I
event.
I did think, why wasn't Jeff there?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that too.
I thought you just couldn't make it, actually.
Because I was at death's door.
Yeah, exactly. We realized...
You were thinking he's got to preserve
his voice. We were thinking about you, actually.
Yeah, thank you.
We were thinking about you.
Yeah. So you had a nice time with George, and he's going to be on the live show.
Yep. And then we've got... this isn't going to be a Sophie Hagen situation, is it?
I had my shoes on.
Then we've got Simon Wesley, who's the former president of the Institute of Psychiatrists. And then we've got Aisha Hazarika, who's
a fantastic friend
of the pod. I think she can have friend of the pod.
She is friend of the pod, yeah.
She's coming back for a second time.
Do you think with Simon at the live show, I can ask him about my various neuroses?
Definitely.
Great.
I think that will be part of it.
Yeah, we should get...
Including about whether you get invited to lunch by people.
That's... We should get a couch up there on the stage with us.
That's true, actually. Yeah. We should put the couch in. And so we've got a live show. Not just the live show, but the...
But we've got into the rag trade, Ed and I. So people have asked us, you know, over the months, are you going to do some T-shirts and so on? And we've been thinking of ways in which we can get the podcast to kind of wash its own face, because, you know, we've got Emma who works on the show. There are various costs involved. I just want to be very clear here. Ed isn't one of those MPs who wants to get his nose in the trough. You're not looking to make money.
Nope.
There's no way that this is going to be siphoned into building a duck house or anything like that for you.
Nope.
Do you promise?
Promise.
So I just want to be very clear in case people think, oh, here we go, old Miliband, you know. What? He's making cut gestures. But I'm being very clear.
You are very clear.
I'm trying to address this brush with which people tar all MPs.
Yeah.
You're not one of those guys.
Nope.
A lot of integrity sitting opposite me.
Definitely.
Me I'm too. Struggling to let the lunch with George Ezra thing go. But despite all that, I'm sitting opposite a good man.
Yeah.
And we've launched a little online store. So there are various reasons to be cheerful. Jumpers and T-shirts and tote bags and hats and the like. And it's early days yet. I tweeted it a couple of days ago. And it'll be interesting to see which things are popular and which things aren't. So, for example, we don't seem to have had much take up on I Want to Live in a Jeffocracy yet.
I think I've bought mine.
Right. I'm getting myself a borderline millennial T-shirt.
You are borderline millennial.
I know.
You slightly were exposed on the borderline millennial front because you kind of, you sort of... I think collectively we overreached on bully, really. You know, we thought that our bullseye reminiscences, we thought that would sort of, you know, go, or you thought it would go viral.
Let me explain what we're talking about here. So last week, you will have heard on the podcast, Ed doing his wonderful impersonation of Bendy Bully, the cartoon bull from Bullseye. And I thought we should video that. So we videoed it. I edited it together and spliced it next to the real bully. And I tweeted it. And I thought, oh, you just wait. This is going to be like Ellen at the Oscars. This is going to be the most retweeted thing of all time. And I'll be honest, it had a very underwhelming response. And you tried to suppress it. At first, you told me I wasn't allowed to tweet it.
Yeah, I thought it was slightly kind of beneath my dignity. But then I realised I didn't have any.
You left behind a long time
exactly.
ago.
Exactly. Once I took up with you.
Yeah. So Ed thinks the bully video was too retro. And because our audience is all borderline millennials, that they wouldn't have got the
but
reference.
But also it's the contradiction between the, you know, there's a certain poignancy, isn't there, between the ordering of the borderline millennial T-shirt and the bully epic fail.
We're going to be talking about prisons this week. Have you ever thought about how you would fare in a prison?
Badly.
I think I would be, you know, I think...
Claustrophobia.
I think I'd do okay, you know, like by being the guy who helps the other prisoners with the homework. That's the little niche I think I could carve out in there.
What do you mean the homework?
I don't know. You see it in films. There's a library. There's a little trolley with books on it. There's some guy who hasn't had the advantages of education. And then another prisoner with spectacles, in other words, me, helps them. And it becomes a beautiful friendship.
Wouldn't you be doing like prison radio? Wouldn't you become like really popular and bits of prison radio, and then you'd sort of end up at the end of the film, you'd become the prison governor in some sort of strange kind of sort of, you know, childhood fantasy sort of way. And then you'd run the prison and everybody would be reformed. And then, you know, you'd actually close down the prison because everybody would be rehabilitated.
I can't tell you how much I'm enjoying this little daydream.
Yeah.
Yes. It's almost making me want to offend.
Yeah.
I probably won't.
Better not.
So, in all seriousness, it's horrific.
It's
when
a
you
horrific.
The numbers.
It's a horrific situation. I mean, just to give you some few facts, the UK has the highest incarceration rate in Western Europe, with 150 inmates per 100,000 people. So we've got a prison population of 86,000, including almost 4,000 women. That incarceration rate compares to 101 per 100,000 in France, 76 in Germany, 74 in Norway, and 53 in Sweden. The prison population has risen 82% in the last 30 years.
Wow.
Now, either we've become more criminal or something is wrong.
But it seems strange to me. So if you, no disrespect to Norway or Sweden, but those Nordic countries, they've got the whole way of organising the society. So it's not surprising there's a big difference between us and them. But if you look at France and Germany, we're still like 50% higher than France.
Yeah, and double Germany. Serious assaults in prisons have more than doubled in the last 3 years. Use of community sentences has halved since 2006, despite them being more effective at reducing reoffending. The prison service has lost almost $1 billion from its budget since 2011. Frontline staff numbers are down by almost 7,000. The majority who went to prison, 71%, had committed a non-violent offence. In 2016, 344 people died in prison, the highest on record, 120 of which were suicides. There were 26,000 assaults, that's 500 a week, and riot teams were called out nearly 600 times, and there were more than 2,500 fires and 40,000 acts of self-harm. It's a pretty grim story.
It's horrendous.
It rather suggests that we're right to be doing this as a topic, and I think it has been suggested by people. There's also this quote. So Winston Churchill said, "Show me your prisons and I shall say in which society you live." And that was quoted by one of our guests, Nils Oberg, who's the Director General of the Swedish Prison and Probation Service.
Urberry.
Nils.
Urberry.
Is that the pronunciation?
So the letter O at the beginning has got two dots over it. So it's not a letter O. It's the letter Ur. Sweden has 29 letters in its alphabet. It has an extra three vowels, one of which is Ur.
Amazing. And also, we're going to be talking to Vicky Price, economist and author of Prisonomics. Vicky Price wrote her book after being sentenced to 8 months in prison for accepting her ex-husband's penalty points on her driving license from 10 years earlier. But she's going to be talking about what she believes should be done in terms of reforming prisons. And then we're going to be talking to Charlie Faulkner, Lord Faulkner, who was the last Lord Chancellor and the first Justice Secretary, somebody who believes that we do need big reform in the way prison policy works. I'll just say one other thing, which is I was talking to a Conservative MP this week who said to me that his wife was a big fan of the podcast. And oddly enough, I then said to him we're going to be doing prison policy. And he went straight to this issue of the political atmosphere and the press reaction to any reform, quote unquote, letting people out, community sentences going soft and all that. And I think one of the reasons we've got not just Nils and Vicky, who are, if you like, experts, but also we thought it was right to have Charlie on, is because we've got to talk about the politics of this, because you can't talk. This is an area which is so kind of where there's such a sort of toxic atmosphere in terms of the press and the way it's covered.
Well, it's a funny one, isn't it? Because sort of evidence and public attitude are quite a long way apart. There's a thing from the National Audit Office saying there's no consistent correlation between prison numbers and levels of crime. And, you know, the press love running a story about how prisoners, it's like they're at a luxury hotel, which is, you know, a long way from the truth. Yeah. But aside from that, you know, looking at what works in terms of rehabilitating people and bringing reoffending and thus the crime rate down. Yes, victims need to feel like they're getting justice, but you also sort of have to look at what works, right?
And also, how do we navigate? I think the thing we've got to work out is, I think there's an area where lots of people know what needs to be done, I guess. And we'll be hearing that from Nils and Vicky. But the question then is, how do you navigate the politics of this?
And coming in to pitch ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful, we're joined by comedian Glenn Moore, who's really good. He's hot on his topical stuff. And you may know him from the Absolute Radio Breakfast Show as well.
More, I want more.
Well, it's happening. More.
Good.
Yeah.
More, like not it? Less.
Yeah.
Right, what's your reason to be cheerful?
Oh, Ed, I've barely done anything, but I did get to go and see Paddington 2. At the end of last week, which I know I'm stealing your reason to be cheerful from about 2 weeks ago.
That's right.
But you're quite right. I mean, it is just unbridled joy, film, isn't it? So, yeah, I enjoyed that very much indeed.
My reason to be cheerful is that I am going to be on this commission that the housing charity Shelter is doing about the future of council housing, social housing in Britain. And it's a really good bunch of people that they've assembled. The vicar of the Notting Hill Methodist Church near Grenfell Tower is going to be the chair of it. That's Mike Long. Doreen Lawrence, obviously, you know, Stephen Lawrence's mother, who's also a baroness. Saeeda Varsi, Conservative peer, sort of a Grenfell survivor. Edward Dufferne. A huge range of people that they've assembled. And the point of this is really twofold. One, we need a lot more social housing in our country, and I hope we're going to come forward with recommendations to try and make that happen. And then secondly, we need to hear the voices of council tenants properly in the way that their housing is run, and that's obviously one of the lessons of Grenfell. This isn't looking specifically at why Grenfell happened and all that. That's for the official inquiry, but it is trying to respond to that rightful demand for change that we heard after Grenfell. I think the danger is when these tragedies happen, everybody at the time says, this mustn't be forgotten, we must act. But then it's very easy for the caravan to move on and people not to act. And so that's why I was pleased to be asked to be doing this. I think it's an important initiative.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So we're joined, I'm delighted to say, by Nils Oberg, who is the Director General of the Swedish Prison and Probation Service. Nils, thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, and thank you very much for having me.
Nils, if you were talking to a member of the public, either the Swedish public or the British public, and you had to explain the way you see the role of prisons, I know that's quite a difficult question, but how would you explain your Swedish approach?
Well, when we do that, we start by, pointing out that we're dealing with human beings, and that, our job is to deal with those in our society who are perhaps the most exposed and at risk. And a prison sentence is usually, at least in our professional view, increases the risks of reoffending unless you do something. So you have to have a strategy in order to figure out how to deal with all these issues that people have, and that in the end explains why they are committing crime. So if the ultimate purpose is to increase security in society, you need to work with these people. And I think the good news from our point of view is that most of the problems that people who commit crimes have are dynamic issues that can be fixed. There's only one thing that we can't do anything about, and that's the criminal act that they have committed. That's done. We can't do anything about that. But that's for the police and the prosecution and the courts to deal with. What we're dealing with is the future, and we're dealing with human beings, and we're trying to fix their problems.
And how do reoffending rates compare with other countries?
Well, we have, I think, we're proud of what we're achieving. We're now down to, I think, 29.3% of our offenders that reoffend within 3 years. So we measure not in a 1 year span, but in a 3 year span. And I think that's, internationally, that's a pretty okay figure. I think the good news is that it's been dropping for the past 13 years. So we were at, I think, 40-some percent, and we're now down to 29. So it's still dropping. So that's very good.
But you have a different philosophy, don't you? You've said to our profession, incarceration must always be the last resort. You seem to take a different approach to quite a lot of offenders than we do.
Well, I think we decided at political level a long time ago that one of the key tasks of a prison and probation system is to make people better and to reintegrate them back into society. So, I mean, there's been a fundamental understanding in this country that people are incarcerated for a fixed period of time, and then they will return back into society. And one of the advantages, of course, is that you can do a lot of things to try to address all the issues that people bring with them into prisons. And we've had a great deal of focus on trying to deal with those issues over a long period of time. And that, of course, I think makes a difference.
And Nils, is that idea, that philosophy of, rehabilitation over punishment, is that something there is support for across the political spectrum? So you have a Social Democrat, left-leaning government at the moment, but you also have the Moderaternas who've been in government more recently. When there's a Conservative government in power, do they apply the same philosophy? Is that the consensus?
Yes, I would say there's a broad political consensus on the fundamental ideas that governs the way we carry out prison sentences in this country. I think there may be a difference in terms of how politicized these issues are. Questions on how we carry out our work has not been, a focal point of the political debate for a very long time. It happens to be one now, in the upcoming elections in September this year, but it's the first time in many decades that these issues have been on the political agenda. And what that means, I think, is that we have been able, as a profession, to take lead in terms of designing the kinds of programs and rehabilitation strategies that we apply. It's not been a political issue, it's been a professional issue.
I think I'm right in saying, Nils, that as well as doing the rehabilitation of prisoners, which you talk about, which sounds very, very important, and I suspect is quite different from what we do here, you're also more prone to using community in other sentences which don't involve people being incarcerated. Is that right?
Yeah, two-thirds of those who have are sentenced will serve some kind of community sentence, supervision, and one-third will be incarcerated. And we also have very short prison sentences in this country compared to many other jurisdictions. And I think the idea behind that is that, prison, I don't belong to those who say that prison sentences don't work. I think they work just fine, provided you are very careful with who are in the prisons. And that goes both for the inmates and the staff, of course. So I think one of the keys is to make up your mind as to what the purpose of a prison sentence is, and to make sure that you also fill it with meaningful activities during the time people are there.
And what are the kinds of meaningful activities that people would be doing in Sweden, perhaps, that maybe they wouldn't get a chance to do in the UK?
Well, one of the things that we can see is that this is a country of, generally speaking, well-educated inhabitants. The people who come to us are not well-educated. They have huge lack of schooling. So one of the things that we prioritize is to try to fix that problem. And that goes for basic schooling as well as higher educational programs and vocational training programs. We know that half of the people that come to us have absolutely no connection with the labor market, for example. So that's another issue that we try to address during a prison sentence, to try to prepare people and to make them competitive in the labor market. That's very important.
And tell me this, and it goes to the question that Jeff was sort of asking. How much pressure is there from, for example, the newspapers in Sweden? Because one of the issues here, I'm not blaming the press, but one of the issues here is that when prison ministers or home secretaries of any party, justice secretaries, want to do something, they are immediately anxious that they're going to be said to be soft on crime by tabloid newspapers and so on. Do you have anything like, do you recognize anything like that in Sweden?
Yes, I mean, I think what you're referring to is something that we see in many different countries, is the tough on crime rhetoric. And that's all over the place, including in Sweden. As I said before, one of the advantages I think we have is that we have made a very clear separation of powers, where much of the how we do things is tasked with the profession. So it's not subject to a political debate. You know, the politicians and the government, you know, we're a government organization like many others, and the government tells us what they want us to achieve. But then it's pretty much up to us to decide the best strategies to get there. And that's the profession. And that means, I think, that if there is pressure on what we're actually doing in our system, that comes directly to us rather than to our politicians.
But the sentencing guidelines and so on would still be decided by politicians, is that right?
Absolutely. And we have the same tough on crime debate as you do and as other European countries have. And I think we have seen the same development over the past, I would say, 10 to 15 years with increasingly harsher, sentences for serious crime. And the government is constantly proposing new, increased sentences for serious crime. So we have the same kinds of trends here as you do in that respect.
And tell us about this. We haven't really talked about it, the treatment of the staff, the prison staff, because I think you've got your staff to prisoner ratio in your prison and probation system is almost 1-1, I believe. It feels like a very different approach when it comes to the staff who work for the service. Is that right?
Well, yeah, and that's, for us, that's key. I mean, if you have high ambitions in terms of doing meaningful things during a prison sentence, somebody has to do it, and that's going to be your staff. So unless you're well-staffed and the staff is well-trained, your ambitions will never come true in this area. So that's one important factor. The second one, I think, which should not be forgotten, is prison, the prison environment as such. And we have invested a lot of energy and resources over the past 15 years in regaining control of our prisons. And what I mean by that is, for example, to prevent drugs from entering the prison system. So we've had an upgrade of our dynamic security work over the past 15 years that's been extremely important in order to create the preconditions for example, you know, qualified education or vocational training programs. If people are high on drugs or alcohol, that's simply not going to be an option.
Last question from me, Nils. You quoted in your a recent lecture you gave in the UK, our former Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who said, "Show me your prisons and I shall say in which society you live." Why is that an important thought, do you think?
Well, I think it's an important quote because for somebody, I think, who is familiar with the prison environment, it's very clear that what we're dealing with in our prison systems is a reflection of the society on the outside. It's not a different world, it's the same world. So all the challenges that we face and all the problems that we're dealing with and all the, you know, all the issues that we see with the people that we're dealing with are exactly the same issues that you will find in the society on the outside. And so it's not something different. It's exactly the same. And that's also why I think any society that focuses on increasing security for its citizens are going to have to pay attention to what's being done within the prison system. You know, it's the same. We live in the same world. It's the same people we're talking about.
Nils Aaberg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So we're joined now by Vicky Price, an economist and author of Prisonomics, and Charlie Faulkner, Lord Faulkner, former Lord Chancellor and former Justice Secretary. Thank you so much to both of you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Vicky, let's start with you. Your book, Prisonomics, outlines some of the very serious problems with the prison system in the UK. And you say in the book that prison doesn't work, it's not value for money. Can you explain to our listeners what you see as the main problems with the system?
Well, the interesting thing is if you look at the increase in the population that go to prison, that has been very significant. It's doubled in the last 25 years. I'm afraid it did double, or it rose very, very quickly under Labour too. So that was, in fact, what started all off, the attempt to by Tony Blair and others to be seen as tough on crime and a party to be trusted by the electorate in this respect. But while this was going on, of course, crime rates have been falling and falling quite significantly, and not because people have been going to prison, but for other reasons. So if you look at it from the economic point of view, it's because we were becoming richer as a nation, or people were getting older. So in fact, the top age for crimes is 24, 25. And in addition, there's been a lot of technology that has been introduced, such as better alarms. Now, of course, people can get into cars again a little bit more easily, so that needs to be upgraded. But basically, you couldn't steal a car as easily. You couldn't burgle houses as easily. So technology has actually changed things significantly, as it has, for example, in stealing from shops because of the way in which the automated cashier tills now work. So crime had been going down, and yet we've been putting a lot more people in prison. So you wonder, first of all, whether it made any sense and whether people were going to prison for different reasons rather than necessarily to reduce crime. And the other thing, of course, is that if you look at all the evidence that's available, it shows very, very clearly that prison is not a deterrent for crime. What is a deterrent is if you are absolutely certain you're going to be caught. And look what's going on right now, for example. Burglaries have gone up very significantly because the police simply doesn't turn up to do their job at all on this. They have different areas of focus. So people don't think they will get caught, and actually they don't. Very, very small percentage of people go through the justice system.
Right. And do you see lots of people, from your analysis, are there lots of people in prison who are in prison and shouldn't be? And who are they?
The one element, of course, that I have seen is women who have done something relatively trivial, very often in order to respond to pressure from others, particularly the pimps or other men in their lives. So, and those crimes can be quite trivial in the sense of, you know, stealing. In some cases, of course, they're more worrying, such as drugs. But again, what you need to be looking at is what is it that gets them to the point of committing this crime? Second, whether there's any point at all in putting them in prison rather than doing something about their conditions. Many of them are drug addicts or they suffer from alcohol abuse. And many of them are uneducated. In fact, almost half of the women who go to prison, half of all the prison population has no qualifications whatsoever. And of course, they very often have been subjected to domestic physical abuse and other type of abuse. So they are vulnerable before they commit the crime. And therefore, they should be treated in a different way to ensure that they don't, when they come out, commit the crime again, because that defeats the purpose of the exercise.
And what would you like to see done in terms of changes to prison policy, both on women in prison and more generally?
Well, more generally, in fact, you need to be looking at education and employment. Again, the evidence shows that the higher the education level of a person is, and if they have jobs, which, of course, if they go to prison, they come out, they're very unlikely to get one, that tends to reduce crime. And given that reoffending in particular, when people come out of prison, is very high, that costs the economy huge amounts of money every year. It's estimated between 9 and 13 billion a year.
This is reoffending rates.
Reoffending rates. Well, you should do something else. And what, of course, has already happened is that there's been a lot of pressure on having, for example, women centres, doing things with women rather than sending them to prison, helping them beforehand, and also if they do commit a crime, dealing with them in a very different way to ensure that they get the skills and the ability just to function in society and perhaps also contribute to society in the future rather than go to prison, come out and actually get worse as a result rather than better.
Why are our numbers per 100,000 people, per 100,000 of population, so much higher than other comparable countries? So we're almost double Germany. We're not just talking about countries where inequalities are focused, like Norway or Sweden, but comparable European countries. They're putting far fewer people in prison than us. Why are we doing that? What evidence are we using?
We didn't used to do that. We were actually pretty much average just 25 years ago. And if you look even further back, there was a big attempt to reduce the number of people in prison around wartime, for example, and so on. And that worked. Now, why there should suddenly have been this change, I'd put it down to politics, I'm afraid. It is that there was a Labour Party there that wanted to be seen to be more middle of the road, more right-wing, and therefore attract the votes. And all sorts of things happened. Sentences were increased. There are many more right now, offences that you can go to prison for. And of course, we have seen all sorts of new things emerging, such as sexual abuse, historic sexual abuse and other cybercrime we haven't quite got our head around of yet. I think there are very few convictions there. But there has been an increase in the sentencing time scales. In other words, where life before could have meant just 8-10 years, now it's considerably longer than that. And there's been also a reluctance to let people out on leave. You can actually get permits to not spend time in prison, but actually be back with your family. A lot of that proved for quite some time harder to get under various regimes, actually reinforced by the Conservative government.
Charlie, tell us, in your view, are there too many people in prison?
There are too many people in prison, yes.
And who are the people that shouldn't be in prison?
I think the two groups of people who shouldn't be in prison are the persistent offenders, where all you can do is send them to prison because everything else has been tried, and also those who are defaulting on sentences that are outside prison. They break the rules and they come into prison.
So they shouldn't be in prison?
They shouldn't be in prison, because what you've got to do is focus much, much more on trying to keep people out of prison by having sensible alternatives to it. Vicky is right that Labour supported, but so did the Conservatives, from about the end of the 80s, much harsher prison sentences. But I think it reflected society's...
Michael Howard did this prison work, didn't he?
Yeah, but then Tony Blair said, tough on crime, yeah, tough on the cause, yeah, of crime. They both did it. But they were reflecting not just the normal view that people have, we want to be tough on crime, people want criminals to go to prison who are dangerous, but also because society's attitudes changed to things like sexual violence. So whereas in the mid-80s, you might get 2 to 3 years for a rape, the way that sentencing went, the figures for rape went up to sort of 7 years as the sort of starting point, and everything went up. If you asked people now, do you think the sentences for violence or for sexual violence are right or wrong? I mean, interestingly, when you do a study, you say, well, what would you, as a member of the public, give this rapist or this person who's violent? They normally give about a sort of double what the courts give them. You've got to be able to cope with the fact that as a society, we've got to be able to reflect what people's views are on those things. But what do you do with a drug addict who repeatedly commits burglary? You've got the crappiest sort of probation arrangements, getting even more crappy as less money is spent on them. You've tried everything. Nothing works. The courts have ultimately to send these people to prison. You give somebody probation who you haven't sent to prison. You say you've really got to comply with the instructions that you've been given. They don't. How do you make that a real sentence? You've got to send them to prison.
But can we just draw a distinction here, and forgive me if this is an ignorant question, between the people who commit violent offences and non-violent offences? Because as I understand it from the figures, 71% of the people in prison have committed a non-violent offence. Yeah. So you know, some people might think, well, you know, life shouldn't mean 6 years or whatever. But most of the people who are in prison are not people who've committed sexual violence or murder or anything, aren't they?
Well, the reason why the prison population doesn't go down is because people are now in for very much longer. What happens where you've got a penal system that does not have an alternative once you've tried everything and everything out of prison is basically crap? And Vicky's point, when you're discharged from prison, there's absolutely nothing that's been done in prison to help you. You've got no support when you get out, so you come straight back. I mean, if you're confronted with somebody who has committed 27 domestic burglaries, and domestic burglaries, people are very upset by domestic burglary, you can't just say, sorry, we've tried everything, we give up. Off you go.
It's a failure to stop the reoffending that is the problem.
Correct. Or having an alternative that people would think will make a difference. The courts, the Magistrates Court and the Crown Court, they're losing confidence big time in alternatives to prison. So they do a case, the people say, this person burgled my house, took photographs I've never recovered. I felt terrible. My children were very, very upset for weeks and weeks and weeks. What do the courts do? Are they supposed to say, well, obviously you shouldn't go to prison because it'll just make you worse, which it will. We'll just sort of let you off with a non-custodial penalty, knowing that everybody in the room, in the courtroom, thinks, well, that's just letting the guy off. So it's very, very difficult. There needs to be a fundamental rethink. It's the sort of stuff that, you know, Gove was talking about. There needs to be a fundamental rethink.
This is Michael Gove when he was Justice Secretary.
Precisely. But it was complete, you know, hot air, because you're never going to make any difference in prison if the prisons are so awful that, I mean, I don't know if you saw the stuff about Liverpool the other day. It was the worst prison inspection ever. They'd opened up cells that every thought were unsafe. There isn't enough prison officers. If what you're trying to do is stop people stabbing each other in prison, you're never going to get to any rehabilitation thing. There needs to be a fundamental rethink. You mentioned in the introduction that I was the Justice
charge of prison for 2 months.
For 2 months. Right? Actually, 6 weeks, I think.
Six weeks.
A very, very short period of time. And at the moment I became...
Did you make any difference in the six weeks?
The moment I became Justice Secretary, Mr. Philip Wheatley, who was then in charge of the prison service, came to see me. And he said, I don't know if you know this, but every afternoon between 4:30 and 7, when people are sentenced to prison or remanded in custody, there are Serco vans circling the M25 waiting to be told where there is a gap in the prisons for them to go to. And if you do not, he said, wagging his finger at me, reduce the prison population, I will, without warning, say the prisons are now too full and you've got to do something about it. The political incentive to do anything about improving conditions in prison is nil, because the Prime Minister and the Chancellor are always thinking, I don't want to spend money on making prison conditions better. But if you don't do something about it, you're not going to make any progress in dealing with it.
But of course, it's not making them better. The reality is that the ministry's budget has been cut and cut again. It's one of the easy ones to do. And therefore, you're left with the prison, not just the prison population, but the officers who are themselves demoralised. Yes. So my serious view is that the majority of the prison officers are doing the job as best as they can, and they try to treat prisoners with dignity. But if you have absolutely no money to have enough officers there, particularly on the weekends, to take prisoners to various places such as education and also some sort of leisure activities that they need to do to remain sane, You just make the whole process worse.
Yeah. We've got this thing called the Jeffocracy on this podcast, yeah. which is Jeff ruling the world. Let's say that in the Jeffocracy, he decides to make Lord Faulkner and Vicky Price the joint justice secretaries in charge of the prisons. What would you do?
The first thing is that you would actually start to get the public on your side. And the interesting thing is, if we're thinking back of what was going on when Michael Gove was there, is that there was a series of reports in the quite right-wing papers, which were beginning to say that prison doesn't work, and that certainly putting women in particular in prison, given the huge costs in terms of what it means for their children, who end up in care and then they commit crimes themselves. So actually the cost of society is enormous. So there started to be a debate which seemed to be accepted. And of course, if you remember, Cameron went behind all that and said, was behind him and said, yes, absolutely, this is so. So you have to educate the public up to a point. There is no way you can do it and risk completely your political career if you don't get the backing of everyone else.
So is the public sort of default position, yes. Lock him up and throw away the key?
Absolutely. And of course, what the public doesn't realise is that people who walk around them are or have done, are criminals themselves, in inverted commas. Very large percentage have done exactly that.
I don't agree with that.
I think when the public are worried about sentencing, I suspect it's not only about this, but it's a lot about more serious crime.
Yeah, I quite agree with that.
Yes, but unfortunately, the way that it works is that lots of people end up in not having done serious crimes in there. So you need to educate the public about that aspect of it. And that was what all those articles over that period were about. Of course, you have to deal with violent crimes seriously. But even before Holloway closed, the governor of Holloway, which was a women's prison, was saying that out of about 450 women who were in there, only perhaps 50 should be in there. Right. The rest were no threat to society. Right. And I think it is important to bear in mind that as I said earlier, because very few people, a very small percentage, actually goes through the criminal justice system, there are loads of people out there that you see when you walk down the street who've either already been in prison, come out, or have already committed an offence, or others who have simply not gone near it. And so I think the second thing that is important to explain is that, in fact, the rehabilitation matters, or taking people away from proper work and so on actually leads to worse results. And if you want to reduce crime, which costs you hugely, you need a different approach than sending people to prison. So my first thing would be work towards actually halving the prison population over a period of time, and certainly thinking of categories that no longer have a jail sentence attached.
Really got to be tough on violent crime and sexual violence. And as a politician, you should rightly reflect that and say absolutely no budging on that. And if you are, and it's not just about sending people to prison, it's also about ensuring there's a lot of effort put into that as far as the police are concerned. You need really to focus on non-custodial interventions and interventions in prison for people who do go to prison, and support after they come, which is quite intense. The experience of being the Justice Minister is that interventions to work have to be quite intense.
And take money.
What you can never do, even though the transaction is obvious, as Vicky says, if you switched a bit money from prisons to non-custodial interventions, then you would have a situation where you would have less people in prison. The problem is you've got people in prison at the moment, and we've got that difficulty now. The government has outsourced probation. It's terrible now, because the only intervention now is you ring up your probation officer and say, I'm still around. That's not going to make any difference as far as people are concerned.
So this is for people who are out of prison?
Those people who are given non-custodial sentences, right. Alternatively, those who've been right. in prison and are released on license.
What community sentences work, though?
The ones that work are ones that, for example, require you to do various bits of cognitive therapy, ones that involve some degree of training, ones that involve somebody, for example, saying, look, let's help you get work, let's help you
get...
So it's
less about restitution to the victim and more about making
Absolutely.
Sure you don't re-offend. And that's the guarantee. That's what Nils was saying to us. That's the sort of guarantee of security to people. Look, we're going to make sure this person doesn't offend again.
Precisely. But it does. You can't do it on the cheap. You've got to do it. So the government has got, I honestly think, a huge opportunity that's going to be forced on them. The state of the prisons at the moment is absolutely catastrophic. And catastrophic, those who know think it's worse than it was before Strangeways. Strangeways was a huge riot that went on for absolutely days. Because as Vicky is saying...
In the 1980s,
that's right. And the what Vicky's describing is prison officers doing their best, but ultimately the way it works is you've got, say, three prison officers having to manage a wing of maybe 150 offenders, many of which are violent. It depends upon trust and it depends upon mutual respect. That goes if you're locked up in your cell for 23 hours a day and there are cockroaches, as the recent thing, the recent inspectorate report identified in Liverpool and Nottingham, that are chewing away at you. There's going to be a huge explosion. The extent to which there are prison riots or things short of prison riots going on month after month is not sort of breaking through. The government has got to act. It's going to be forced to act. It should invest money both in better prisons and more prison officers, but it should also invest money in the support for prisons when they come out and non-custodial sentences.
But the interesting thing is that it is much cheaper to do that support outside the prison than it is putting people in prison. I mean, it actually costs something like education at a very top private school per year to put somebody in prison. Right. And then, of course, if you also...
It's hard to believe that,
women,
isn't it?
Because extraordinary.
The quality, I mean, I can't believe that Pentonville has the same conditions as Eton.
It is actually cheaper, and the reoffending rate is considerably less from every alternative to prison that has been piloted. So instead of spending £35,000 per person, you spend up to 10, between, five to 10.
The agenda that me and Vicky are talking about, it's I have a sort of sense politically that it's time maybe about to come, in the sense that Trump, with some right-wing governors in the United States of America, the governor of Kentucky and the governor of Kansas, both made a quite significant intervention the other day, saying you've got to focus much, much more on rehabilitation. I think because he understands, particularly looking at what's called his base, that they, the people in his base, are aware that the extent to which you are a defendant, the extent to which you are a victim, is interchangeable. And that if Trump and the Republican governor of Kansas and the Republican governor of Kentucky are saying things need to change, Mrs. May, because it ultimately depends upon the prime minister driving it, has an opportunity.
We've reached the point where austerity is actually a good thing from that point of view, because it will force the government to do something about it. It's a crisis point. Yeah. And therefore, if you can't afford to keep these people there and you get those terrible reports like we just got from Liverpool, for example, then you've got to act. And since there is no real money, and now, of course, look at what happened to all these PFI contracts for prisons and so on. If there is no money to really build wonderful, enormous new prisons that they intended to do, then one has to look at the evidence and say, it doesn't make any sense to put these people there. We should do something with it. And given that it actually leads to a reduction in crime, it could be a win-win. But as I was saying earlier, you've got to sell it in a certain way that is acceptable to your own party and, of course, to the population as well.
I'm wondering about whether or not if Kansas, Kentucky and Trump are for it, maybe it won't be.
Let's just talk about the politics for a second, Charlie, because it was in particular you had experience of this. Talk to us about prison ships.
The politicians not engaged in this area are just sort of one club. Politicians, they're not interested in it. They're exactly as Vicky and you've been saying. They're just saying, basically, go anywhere in prison reform and that loses your votes, basically. When I became the Justice Minister, I was rung up both by the Prime Minister and the Chancellor. Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. And asked, would I look at the issue of prison ships?
And why was that, Charlie?
Because the reason they, in fact, rung me up, I have reason to believe, is because the editor of The Sun at the time was interested in it. So the only thing that sparked the politicians to get into this issue was...
Did you speak to the editor of The Sun about prison ships?
No, I did not.
You didn't?
No, and I looked into the question of prison ships. They are, for a whole variety of reasons, completely ludicrous as an idea. And indeed...
I mean, this prison ships thing didn't go away, did it? Because Ken Clark became the Justice Secretary in 2010.
When David Cameron was the Prime Minister.
He was summoned to a meeting with Rebecca Brooks.
Correct, that's
about
right.
Prison ships.
Yeah, prison ships are I think, a sort of symbol to the Sun newspaper that to be really tough on crime is to put people in the middle of...
Are the prison ships supposed to go to Australia? Or
no, leave them in the middle there somewhere.
Wander around.
I think it was intended that you should be taken onto the prison ship, probably left in the Thames basin.
It seems extremely problematic.
Very problematic, and very much more expensive than an ordinary prison, very difficult to make secure for a whole variety of reasons, and safety in sight. If there was, for example, a prison riot and a prison on a prison
ship, it would be bad news.
It would be extremely bad
news. You told the Prime Minister and the Chancellor this was a cracker's idea, did you?
I did, and at which point they lost interest completely in prison.
And you threw
it. 6 weeks later, I was gone as Justice Secretary. No, actually, it was exactly, that's right.
That wasn't cause and effect.
Who knows, Ed?
So before we recorded last week's podcast, I had my iPhone grabbed out of my hand by a guy on a moped. Now, I don't think that guy should go to prison.
But from what you said to me.
Yeah, throw away the key. Hanging's too good for them. But from what I understand, the police, there's not very much they can do. They can't give chase because they're worried, if one of these people get into an accident, then that will be their responsibility. It's happening so often, they've got no way of keeping tabs on it, really.
But they're not even around to be seen. I mean, that's the real problem.
So please,
let's conjure a scenario for you. We find the person that stole Jeff's phone, and we find they've stole 30 other phones, and we find that they're in their house 30 iPhones that are not theirs.
Yeah.
Right. In the Vicky Charlie world, in the Jeffocracy, what happens to them?
Well, my view, we assume he's not had any previous conviction, then you don't send him to prison. What you do is you subject him to an intensive campaign of trying to make him go straight in relation to it. Because what you want to achieve by your penal policy is that there shall be no more thefts.
He wouldn't go to prison, or she wouldn't go to prison.
She would not go to prison. Well, actually, there's a period of time when the mobile phone theft was incredibly high. The Lord Chief Justice, Lord Bingham, sentenced somebody to 9 years in prison for the first offence of stealing a mobile phone, which had an effect on reducing the amount of mobile phone thefts. But everybody realised that was a little bit severe, and I would not support that. You need to do a non-custodial sentence for somebody if it's the first offence.
But that happens at the moment.
It would normally happen at the moment, but then nothing would happen. So what we say is some sort of community payback, go and dig the roads for 10 minutes, or a fine.
Would that happen at the moment?
That would happen at the moment.
And that doesn't have any effect because they dig the roads and then go out and carry on stealing mobile phones.
They dig the roads for once a week, or even worse, they're put in probation, which means they ring their probation officer who say, thank you for ringing, good afternoon.
And if they repeat offending at the moment, they would end up in prison.
Precisely, because there's no alternative.
Okay, and in the Vicky, what would you say? Let's say they're a repeat offender, just to make it more difficult.
Well, I accept that you have to do something to stop that repeat offending that goes on, because then, you know, they of course think they're not going to get caught, so they do it again and again, and then they do get caught, which happens very often with violent crimes. You get caught with lots of other stuff, you don't as much, but I would do certainly, you know, after the first one, possibly even with the first one, you give a suspended sentence, you make them pay something back over a period of time, if they haven't got it immediately. You actually impose different types of penalties on people, which doesn't take them necessarily away from their work and actually gives them an encouragement to do something better in the future.
At the moment, that, you know, there's the case of the person who was given a suspended sentence and then on Facebook said, ha-ha, I got away with it. The judge, as it happened, then pulled him back and sentenced him to prison on the basis that that's not what she, the judge, was intending. But if you've got nothing to offer except hopeless community penalties outside, then people will reoffend and everybody will think they're getting away with it until they go to prison. And that's why you've got to invest not in digging the roads, but in something that's going to make a difference. Labour introduced the Youth Justice Board in 1997, and there were intensive support and life-changing interventions made.
And youth incarceration did actually fall, did it, as a result of the Youth Justice Board?
Reoffending.
This is exactly what we want. It's the reoffending that we don't want to happen. And that's why, you know, putting them in prison doesn't help. But if you have the other services, the women's centres that were started, which got very little funding in the end, or at least are under threat right now, are the ones which have a very good track record of ensuring that all these problems are dealt with for women, and that they can then become proper members of the community. And work is really, really, really important. One of the things that I do is I'm a patron of a charity called Working Chance, which finds quality jobs for ex-offenders. And that is a
massive problem, isn't it? Because they have it on their CV that they, or not CV, but it gets known about that they were a prisoner.
Exactly.
And then it's very hard to get a job.
And without a job, you can't rebuild your life. And what do? You reoffend.
Can I give you another example? So I got ripped off by one of these show business accountants, and he ended up going to jail for 6 months. And I can feel quite bad about that because I think he's a guy who had some kind
That's why Jeff ended up with me, basically.
Yeah, yeah. and like, what should have happened to him? Like, he can't practice accountancy anymore, and his life is ruined. So I sort of feel like that's enough. Like, what happens to someone like that?
I mean, in my book, it depends on the scale, obviously. But for a guy who rips people off like that, you've got to financially break them, bankrupt them.
Which I think is what
happened. Take every asset that they have stolen from people like you and give it to people like you. But prison is a completely pointless alternative. That, you know, if you're Madoff and you've run off with millions and millions of pounds, then maybe you might have to send people to prison there. But for financial crime, generally, do not send people to prison.
I agree with that. And again, I mean, the interesting thing is that the people who get caught in this, so there are young girls working in an office where things are passed through them, and somehow or other they get also associated with this, and they end up in prison. So it's completely pointless, ruins their lives forever. So different ways of dealing with it have to be looked at. And then, of course, you put them right next to violent criminals. And that can have quite a substantial impact on lives.
Where does the idea that prisons are luxurious come from? I'll still get taxi drivers saying to me, oh, it's like being in a luxury hotel in prison with flat screen TVs.
I think it comes from the picture of open prisons. I think it comes from the fact that
there are very few of those, by the way.
There are very few of those, I agree. It also comes in part from people like Grayling, and this is not a political point, but it's a superficiality of saying, let's take away Sky TV.
The books. He tried to ban books.
And books. and giving the impression that they're all watching television and reading books, I mean, which is not the height of...
But also, what could be more contrary to the idea of rehabilitation than banning books?
Yeah. Exactly. But it's part of this one-dimensional view that you've got to be tough on all prisoners. And when you are living in a community and you can see people going into prison who, as I say, might be victims, might be defendants, people with a bit more knowledge, including people in communities, realise it's not like that at all.
But there have been television programmes showing conditions in various prisons, and very good ones too. I think it should be required watching by the taxi drivers if that's what you're worried about.
I want to ask you both one final question. You've been appointed co-justice secretaries in the Jeffocracy.
It's going well.
You've set out your plans. Think about the public who are listening and explain to them why it's in their interest to have this prison reform.
There will be less crime in the future if that is the case. And that's the main reason. There is just no doubt in terms of looking at the evidence that by educating people better, by not putting them in prison, by doing the right rehabilitation, if you want to call it that, you end up as a richer society with less crime.
Yeah, and you're reflecting as well what the public are thinking. We will be tough on violent and sexual offenders, but we will be helping people, as exactly as Vicky says, to reduce crime, and you'll be safer as a result.
Well, I'm pleased to say that you've both got the job. Thank you very much for joining us.
What do you reckon then?
Well, there's a lot of moving parts. Currently, it sounds like we've got the priorities of each of those things slightly wrong.
I suppose the thing I learned from this is that often these things are sort of thought about separately, but maybe justice demands the rehabilitation of the offender more than I really. In other words, if the offender isn't rehabilitated, they're probably going to do it again.
Yes.
And therefore, okay, you might not have your phone stolen again, but somebody else is going to. And therefore, an element of justice for the victim is the sense this won't happen again, or this person won't do it again. And I think that's the thing I learned the most, which is, you know, people often talk about non-custodial sentences, and we are talking about non-violent offenders, I think. And non-custodial sentences, that sounds like, you know, community service or whatever, but even more important than that is, well, what happens to the person? You know, Sweden sounds like it invests a lot of money in stopping that person reoffending.
Yeah, and it was very interesting the way that Nils framed it as well, in terms of that stuff that we're just talking about, like the justice and the punishment. That's the job of the police and the equivalent of the Crown Prosecution Service. And as somebody working with prisons and prisoners, his job is specifically that rehabilitation, not any of the rest of it.
Yeah, and then there's the politics of it. And you know, Charlie obviously thinks that the politics is changing. What's happening with the right wing? You know, some right wing Republicans now saying, and admittedly, America is through the roof when it comes to the prison population. I think there's even a character on Sesame Street whose father is in prison.
Right, I mean,
it's so common in the US. I hope he's right. The politics is changing. I think he's right to say violent offenders are in a different sort of category. Feels to me like he's right. The politics is changing a bit, but there's still some distance to go. I actually began to wonder at the end of that interview whether it's not another area where it would be great to have people like him and former conservative like ministers in charge of this area coming together to say, right, we've got to have change, because maybe a cross-party thing will insulate both parties a bit from being, you know.
I also think the public love that. If they get the idea that politicians from different parties can be grown-ups and work together, I think that reflects very well on the politics and sort of increases public trust in it.
Yeah, I don't think we should underestimate this area. I know we said it at the start, but this area of all areas, you are definitely, if you're in that job of prisons minister or justice secretary, you know, you've got the tabloids breathing down your neck. And it's not just, that sounds a bit like the person's weak, but I think the problem is, as Charlie implied, with prison ships, you then get the prime minister breathing down your neck saying, why am I getting, you know, grief in the newspapers for some policy I don't even know about for, you know, people and all that. And I think that the key point is that this isn't simply sort of liberal do-gooding. It would be, you know, Vicky's point, this is better for all of us if there's less crime and there's less reoffending and it costs the economy less money and all of that. So, you know, this isn't, people can have their own views about whether people should be incarcerated, who should be incarcerated, but this is actually going to make economic and financial and moral sense.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
As ever, we would love to hear your thoughts on what you've just heard, or if you've got an idea for a future episode, share that with us too. You can email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast, or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/reasons to be cheerful.
It's interesting, the Pod Save America people, they do slash.
Do they really?
Yeah.
So you're it's an
maybe it doesn't have the same connotation, slash.
But slash isn't as nice. Why do we keep coming back to this? Who prefers a slash to a stroke?
Forward slash. Right. We've had lots and lots of emails about the NHS.
Yes.
It was longer than Ben-Hur, our episode, for which you rightly apologise. But actually, it has not diminished people's enthusiasm. In fact, quite the opposite. This is from William, who's a junior doctor. He's been there, a junior doctor, for over a decade. I'm about to finish my training. He said, as an aside, Jeff has been making me laugh on the radio for all that time, and Ed has some catching up to do. So that's a nice
boy to man.
That's a nice thing to say. He says, it's great to hear all your guests advocating for more funding for the NHS, which is something we on the inside have been saying for many years. The current underfunding of some services to the point where they are almost unable to function has politicised a whole generation of junior doctors, almost as much as a contract debacle a couple of years ago. And then he says, what's changed is that across the political spectrum, people are calling for more resources. He says the question of where the extra money comes from is a tricky one, and he wants to propose a novel solution. I've wondered about introducing a discretionary or optional charge for using the NHS, a bit like the optional donation that gets suggested when you go to a museum, or the service charge on a restaurant bill. My idea is there will be a suggested optional charge, say £5 or £10, for seeing a GP or a specialist or having a test. People who didn't wish to pay the charge could simply decline, but I don't believe many people who could afford it would do so. I've often heard patients say they would like to contribute for services they've received in the NHS, but there's currently no direct mechanism for doing this. Thank you, William, for your email. I am pretty sceptical about this, I think, for a number of reasons. I think one, we all do pay for the NHS through our taxes. Secondly, I fear it would make people who couldn't afford it feel sort of uncomfortable, because it's like you're not really doing your bit if you're not contributing. And then I'm also really suspicious about politics, because I think the magic of the NHS comes from the fact it isn't about money. And it isn't about leaving your credit card at the door. I think once this came in, politicians would say, well, lots of people are paying it, but some people aren't. Now we should make it compulsory. And then you're right down the slippery slope. I mean, look, I appreciate the creativity. I don't quite buy it myself.
Yeah, you don't want politicians sort of saying, "Oh, look, there's a pot of money we don't need to factor into our budgets."
And it's sort of this the free at the point of use, I think, it's such an important...
Yes.
It just feels founding like principle. Such an important thing.
Yeah. This comes from Jack, who says, "Just wanted to get in touch and say how much I enjoyed the NHS episode. My dog has been very unwell, so I spent most of the night downstairs with him in case he needed my attention, and listened to this episode about 3 times on repeat as I drifted off to sleep."
That's 6 hours.
Yeah. Good for our download numbers.
Definitely.
I hope your dog's feeling better.
Definitely.
Jack continues, "I'm very much right-leaning with my political views, voting Conservative the few times I've been able to vote. I am always keen, however, to test my political opinions, and a friend, massive lefty, recommend I listen to this podcast. Some episode I've listened to have made me cringe."
Can't believe he really meant that.
I hope that's not just our conversation making you cringe.
Yeah, cringe-worthy.
Yeah. While others, such as this one and the land tax one, have really made me pause for thought. Long may it continue. Hope you're both well.
Well, that's very, very nice of Jack. And we appreciate, as I said last week, we appreciate people from all parts of the political spectrum. The next one comes from Adrian. He says, "The NHS is, of course, a brilliant thing. And in your episode, you touched on lots of great points about how the system is currently not working. You and your guests touched on how lack of GP funding and access is leading to greater stress on hospitals, etc. My idea would be for the NHS to take a leaf out of so many private care providers and make it compulsory for people to have an annual health checkup with their GP. Not only would this ensure illnesses are treated earlier, but it would also ensure that vaccinations and boosters are kept up. I also think annual health checks for everyone promote a culture of talking about health and illness more." How about monthly?
Oh, okay. I mean, you're preaching to the choir with me and Ed, because
you're preaching to the hypochondriacs right here.
I've always got a list on the go in my phone of things that I must mention to the doctor. I do think that sort of the economics of it don't add up, because if you spend that much
that
time doing
right.
checkups on people, you very rarely turn stuff up. I know a lot of the American system is based around sort of on incessant checkups and referrals, which can catch stuff, and it does catch stuff, but I think a lot of the time it's just not the best use of a doctor's resources.
Well, I noticed in Dan Pink's book, he says that you have a regular colonoscopy in the American system, which is obviously something we don't do here. I mean, like, I'm all in favor of prevention. I don't know whether quite this works or not.
This comes from Mona Johnson, who says, "I am a one-woman promotion machine of this podcast."
Excellent.
It's something good to hear. "Among my other clinical colleagues at our arm's length body. To echo one of your other listeners, if you want another health stroke NHS topic, might you consider mental health? It's such a rich topic, but a reason to be cheerful is the increasing profile of MHFA England and mental health in schools." She also adds, "Self-harm is so misunderstood. Maybe this is a good place to start." Well, funny you should say that, because that is what our live episode is going to be about, mental health. She says, "Sorry for increasing your workload by writing in."
She read our minds. We don't mind her writing in, do
no,
we?
No, we can't reply to everybody, but we're reading every email that comes
we
in.
We are, definitely. And this one comes from Mike Forsyth. Subject currently on +6. "Hi, Ed G." That's not edgy, that's Ed and G, I think. Ed G, it has a certain ring to it, actually.
Yeah,
get down with Ed G.
I'm not sure it does.
You don't think so?
I think it's a slippery slope.
George Ezra isn't really called George Ezra, you see. He's George Barnett, who did.
We've been lied to.
Well, not really, no, but it's like his stage name. Maybe I should be Ed G. Right.
Like Kenny G.
Or Mr. T. Right. Okay, as a self-confessed guy that gets political at the pub, my friends used to have a paddle of rebuke, see Foster's advert circa 2010. I absolutely love the podcast. It helps me get my nerd fix without the misery of the current news political climate. I'm a keen advocate, and I've currently recruited 6 friends to the cause. Starting to sound a bit cultish. At a recent party, a friend asked for podcast recommendations. What a party he goes to. And instantly, it sounds like a real happening thing.
Hang on. You know, we could start talking about your party days at university.
But they were much less exciting glass houses than that. Funnily enough, we didn't talk about a podcast. And instantly, yeah, no, I'm totally in a glass house on this one. And instantly, me and another uni friend, Pam, barked out reasons to be cheerful. Well done, Pam, before anyone else could answer. Neither of us knew the other was a fan, and the look, nod of knowing and appreciation was palpable, like one of those 90s buddy cop movies. We spent the next 20 minutes fanboy-girling about our favourite episodes. Keep up the good work and we'll keep spreading the word. I think you get a clue there that, you know, extra sycophancy definitely gets you read out on the podcast.
I mean, six. I mean, when we usually read these six things, offensive. I was like, I tried to get my dad to listen, but he thought it was terrible. I mean, this is
Mike Forsyth is definitely top of the leaderboard, I would say.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet @cheerfulpodcast.
And here to pitch ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful, we're joined by comedian Glenn Moore. Hello.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for coming. And you are a busy man because you do the comedy and you are also reading the sport on The Breakfast Show on Absolute Radio.
Yes.
And since you've started that job, are people just obsessed with what time you get up? Because I did a breakfast show many years ago. Mm. And the people just always want to ask you, what time do you get up in the morning? How much sleep do you have?
Yeah, people try and calculate my hours of sleep and then they compare them to figures of the past, so it's always Margaret Thatcher essentially in the 4 hours thing,
right? Yes.
Or Donald Trump, he doesn't sleep very much.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure
you don't drink 14 Diet Cokes a day.
No, but I do eat KFC with a knife and fork, so it all balances.
Yeah, exactly. Do you find the crazier the politician, the fewer hours sleep they have?
Yeah.
How many do you go for?
12. No.
you're not a morning person.
No, I'm a 6 or 7 hour person, but I hate mornings. I do hate mornings, I'm afraid. Some people are just evening person people. And are you a morning person?
No, not at all. No. I mean, Annabelle, who I used to do the breakfast show with, said that it changed her personality doing that show for years. Like, it made her an awful person. Because, I mean, you never get enough sleep, and then you're always sort of calculating how much you should have gotten, trying to catch up as the week goes on.
Yeah, and by the time it gets to weekends, I sort of overexert myself. And so on Saturdays, it's like I'm a kid at a sleepover, and it's sort of like, oh my God, I get to stay up till 4 in the morning? Okay, great. So my hours I'm really messing up my body clock, and I'm aging horribly.
So you brought in some ideas to pitch which could be potential reasons to be cheerful.
Yes.
What's the first one you have for us?
I think one would be adding sort of some sort of fake news element to the national curriculum. So kids are taught things like news bias and how to actually sort of work out sources and how to sort of trust a source. So we get a new generation of people who are actually a bit more sort of skeptical about what they hear about.
Right, so being able to spot fake news and not only that, being able to spot it when there's an influence or an agenda.
Yeah, but even if there's sort of not fake news as such, but even when there's that sort of legally sort of sound bias you can get in sort of a tabloid press, I think it's still important to know that even if, for instance, like I enjoy reading The Guardian, but I sort of got to sort of try and make myself aware that there is still sort of a bias there, and it might not be as openly sort of egregious as something like The Sun newspaper might be considered to be, but at the same time, you're still not necessarily getting that sort of full information.
Ed, is that anything you've ever come across, the press disguising opinion as news? Does that sound familiar to you?
I think it's a really good point, actually, because it is quite scary, particularly in America, but we have our own version of fake news here, but particularly in America, the way that fake news just takes off, doesn't it?
Fortunately, because of things like Ofcom, we can't have something like Fox News over here, which is just so preposterous. It's just an alternative reality. And the people who are hearing about it are under the impression that Hillary Clinton's under investigation by the FBI for a Russia scandal. It's just the opposite of what's going on.
Yeah.
And I think it's so important. But to a much sort of smaller extent in the UK, I think it's sort of important to that you sort of say to a kid, like, if you see a photo in a newspaper, that's not necessarily going to be telling the whole story. Like, for instance, I wouldn't say I'm the biggest fan of Theresa May, but there was a photo of her visiting victims, I think, of the Grenfell Tower fire in hospital. And loads of people were sharing a photo around, sort of saying, look at her body language. She doesn't care about those people. And it's like, well, I mean, I don't like Theresa May, but that's a preposterous sort of thing to take just from that sort of photograph. Or at the same time, like, if the idea that if you get your news from, say, a particularly sort of left-wing source, then you might be under the impression that Jeremy Corbyn is being smeared more than he is, when in reality that's just journalists sort of holding them to account.
And yeah,
I think if you've got to teach kids that if you see something written about a particular politician, you've got to ask yourself, would you consider it insane if they were saying that exact same thing about the opposition?
Yes.
Like the Daily Mail's sort of front page thing after Theresa May's sort of disastrous Tory party conference speech, The front page of a Daily Mail was sort of like rotten bad luck, a bad cough and letters falling down, but the old girl got through it in the end. And you sort of think, well, would the Daily Mail ever write that about Jeremy Corbyn?
They wrote that about me a lot. That was exactly their attitude towards
and it's
me.
It's so preposterous. And if I think it's really important that because it's becoming so much more prevalent, it's becoming more of a talking point.
All right, we'll have that. I think that's a good idea. Educating kids on news bias. Mm. What's your next suggestion?
This next one I think would really change a lot of people's commutes, and I think is as important as fake news, and it's as dangerous as on the rise. Escalators, particularly in sort of underground stations or in very sort of heavily populated areas, tend to have sort of a two-lane system, and one in which you stand on the right-hand side if you're just going down slowly, and then the left-hand side, which is if you're in a rush. I think there should be a third lane, which is if you're in a rush and you are also fast. Because the amount of people who are
overtaking
in a rush,
lane. Yeah.
The amount of people who are in a rush but aren't quick, and it's sort of like no, it's not. Being in a rush isn't sort of a state of mind. You've also got to be able to sort of convert that into speed.
You say this with a great deal of sort of passion. Are you somebody who's quite fast up or down the escalator and you find that there are people in your way?
Yeah, I'd rather race to the top and be a horrible sweaty mess when I arrive. But at the same time, when someone's just painfully walking, but you can't say. You can't tap them on the shoulder and say, sorry, can you move? You're going slower than the people standing still.
Where are you from?
I'm from Croydon.
Right, okay, so you've got that kind of London pace. That's natural to you. That is your natural rhythm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my parents live in a very small village in West Sussex. I mean, every time I go back for Christmas, I just can't bear the idea of people pottering. Is the only way I can sort of describe it, just for... Just the lack of I don't know. It's not so much speed. It's just everyone's happy to just do 10 minutes worth of tasks over the space of 5 hours on this Sunday afternoon, and I can't understand that.
You're not one of the slow movement.
No, and I think they're people who have lived a very, very, very sort of fast life, and at the age of 50 gone, you know what, we're just going to retire and just move to a village and we're going to take things slowly at the complete expense of people in their 20s.
You'd have to redesign all the escalators, presumably, to allow three lanes.
That'd be good for work, though, and a bit of stimulus into the economy, all that money put into TfL.
I think it's a sort of, it's a kind of Franklin, it's FDR.
Exactly.
Jeff Lloyd is FDR with his new escalator plan.
Yeah. Glenn, what do you have next?
I think for everything that's added to the school curriculum, the Department of Education should have to provide an example of how you could possibly use that later in life. So as you're studying algebra, you should be given an example of how you can then use algebra later in life, because otherwise you just get completely switched off to it because you think when on earth is this ever going to happen?
Right. So if they're telling me why I'm learning about an oxbow lake,
exactly, onion skin weathering. If it's put into context, then they should. And as a result,
Oxbow lake. So I remember learning about oxbow lakes in geography, but because they never told me how it would come in handy, I can't remember anything apart from the phrase oxbow lakes.
That's the thing. I can remember so many sort of acronyms or ways to remember things that I don't understand. Like things like sine and cos. I remember there's so many sort of rhymes and stuff. I remember I remember the names of them now, but I don't know what they do.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know. I've got no idea how they function. But I think as well it would mean a lot of the stuff would be a lot of the stuff added to the curriculum would then be more relevant to sort of later in life. Like one of my A-levels was in classics. It was useless.
But the square of the two sides of a right angle triangle are equal to the hypotenuse. How's that useful to life?
Yeah.
It's a good motto to have in life, definitely.
I think it's a good question. Is relevance relevant, if you see what I mean? Does it need to be relevant?
I think it does. Surely
you did classics. What did you do? Classics A-level, did you say?
Yeah. Like, it then helped in my English degree, but occasionally I could sort of pull the Odyssey out of the bag as a quote. But then, the English degree then didn't directly help me.
It helps you to crack jokes on Absolute Radio, I'm sure. It's sort of directly.
Oh, yeah, but really on brand.
Yeah. As Plato would have said. But I'll make a confession here, which is going to sound slightly, maybe not what you'd expect me to say. I wish we'd learned more about like the British Empire. I don't mean in a sort of rah-rah way. I mean in a sort of negative way quite a lot. We didn't really learn about, you know, when I think about the history I was being taught in school, it was this kind of modular history. And so you didn't really get a sense of the context of the country living in.
And I think as well, if you're taught about the British Empire, then you wouldn't necessarily potentially have gone into, say, the Brexit vote going, well, countries will be queuing around the block to form trade deals with us. You sort of think, I don't think they
are. I think
are.
It may be that there was this sort of sense of that it was too controversial, and I don't know why.
But you should be able to, you shouldn't be able to listen to the good stuff about your country if you can't listen to the bad stuff. You can't just have one. You should, you know.
Yeah, but were you taught about that kind of, the British Empire?
No, it was, like I say, it was like a bunch of kings and queens and stuff, and there was so much, like, subsequently.
But I mean,
adult,
later on, I mean, learn, it's like a O-level or GCSE in your case.
No, I'll tell you, we did John F. Kennedy, we did the Second World War and the First World War and the Somme, and we did a little bit of Henry VIII stuff. I think that's
and would you have learned about the British Empire?
I remember.
Never. No, it was all, it was school. Very sort of Germany related, but not necessarily. It was more of the interwar stuff,
so
like the inflation
strange,
crisis,
isn't it? It's like, because it was the whole idea was learning to learn. Okay, well, that's fine, but it's sort of like you didn't get. And I think there are lots and lots of people today who just don't have a sense about the country's history, apart from in a very sepia tinted way.
No, it's exactly that. When what people pick up about the British Empire, a lot of people is just, oh, the sun never set on it, and we gave them railways, and it was all wonderful.
Well, I learned more about the British Empire from Jewel in the Crown, which was a thing that was on when I was growing up. It was probably a bit you were a bit young for it.
It was on, but it was too boring for me as a kid.
But I learned more from that than I did from the history curriculum. I don't want to sound like the Daily Mail here.
What do we want? More period dramas. When do we want them now? Glenn, people can hear you on the Absolute Radio Breakfast Show, and then you're going to be playing around the country if people just look you up on Twitter or whatever.
Yes.
It's the best way, isn't it?
Yeah, easy,
people know how to do
way.
These things.
Yeah,
I don't need to explain it. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
And that was our podcast, another bumper one this week.
Bumper.
It was bumper. And
bumper to bumper.
And the next time we sit here and record another podcast, between now and then, we will have made our West End debut.
Trod the boards.
Yeah.
Break a leg.
Name up in
lights. Don't say break a leg to either of us. Actually, we might. We might break a leg.
Not with your track record.
On the way onto the stage.
I'm trying to think of any theatrical superstitions. You can't, don't wear any green. That's an old theatrical superstition. I can't quite remember why. I think there's something you're supposed to do with mirrors as well, but I can't quite remember.
Apparently.
Go on.
So a French person told me that the French tradition is not to say break a leg, but merde, which doesn't mean break a leg.
No, it means take a poo.
Well,
make a bowel movement.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, will you be doing that before?
No, definitely.
And of course, if it goes well.
Well, we're going to try and do more, aren't we? Because we're getting people increasingly saying to us, when are you going to announce your new dates? We're just trying to find the sort of venues, times when we can do it consistent with other things. So watch this space.
Oh, and I will mention, we were talking about the various bits and pieces, T-shirts and things before. If you're thinking, oh, I wouldn't mind treating myself to one of those, we'll put a link up in the show notes for this episode. So if you look at the notes on the podcast, we always put up links to the various guests and bits and pieces, but you'll be able to find a link and then go on a shopping spree, a drunken online shopping spree.
Should we do some thank yous?
Yeah. Yeah, so thanks to Director General of the Swedish Prison and Probation Service, Niels Öberg.
Yeah.
Or Oberg. Are you like a typical Brit abroad when you go on holiday, just saying things loudly in English?
Loud voices, yeah. I think I should let you do the other pronunciations as well, then.
Okay. Well, thanks to Vicky Price, who I believe is just pronounced Price, despite the fact that it's got a Y in there somewhere, economist and author of Prisonomics, and the wonderful Lord Charlie Faulkner.
Lord Faulkner of Thoroton, actually.
Of Thoroton.
Yes.
And it was very exciting for me, yet again, to have another Lord.
You've lots of lords in your house. Lords are leaping.
They are.
We didn't ask him about the fact he drinks 14 Diet Cokes a day.
No, but maybe we can have him back and ask him about
that. Yeah, definitely.
But thank the Lord.
Sorry. Why?
It never gets old to me, that.
Thank the Lord. Yeah. All right.
And Glenn Moore, bright young comedian. He's ever so good, and you can hear him on the Absolute Radio Breakfast Show. So this is an unusual turn of events. I've thanked all the guests, which means you have to thank everyone else.
No. I think you do that bit so well.
You mean I can remember the names?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, well, first of all, I'll thank our announcer.
Girl loved us.
Yeah. And then I will thank the guy who made the idents.
Ed Seed.
James Deacon.
James Deacon.
And then the music was, of course, written by...
Ed Seed.
And then there was our wonderful artwork...
Emily Power.
...done by Emily Power, who's also done the T-shirts and whatnot. And our programme was produced by...
Emma Corsham.
With policy research and assistance from...
Alex Feist-Bryce and Lindsay Todd.
Look at that. You did it. You put your mind to it. I believed in you.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much.
He's been Ed G, apparently.
He's been that annoying bloke who can pronounce Swedish names.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.